Okay. Also, we got a mazel tov today. It was a bris of a grandson that I had born in Glasgow, Scotland. I guess that makes me the grandfather of a English grandson. Could be worse days.
Scottish.
Well, for the time being, he's still English. A few more months, he may not be English anymore. Okay. I want to start with something depressing. But if we explain it, it won't be that depressing. There's a very, very, very depressing medrash in this week's Sedra. The medrash says like this. I want to give you the background first before I tell you what the medrash says. They built the Mishkan from after Yom Kippur, after they got atonement for the sin of the golden calf. They spent a few months building the Mishkan. It remained not put up until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan was the culmination of a 7-day dedication process for the Mishkan and consecration and installation of the Kohanim. And that's what this week's Sedra starts with, Vayihi Bayom HaShmini. According to most opinions, Bayom HaShmini refers to the 8th day after the 7-day preparation for erecting the Mishkan, and that 8th day was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It was the first day of Nisan. And Chazal say that that day had tremendous simcha. It was the first day of the month. It was a Sunday, the first day of the week. It was the first day that there was a Kohen Gadol in Klal Yisrael, the first day there were regular Kohanim, the first sacrifices they brought were on that day. It was the first day that God's presence came into the Mishkan. The Medrash elucidates 10 special firsts on that day. Okay. And on that day, a tragedy occurred. And two of Aaron's sons died. Happened was, and I don't doubt if we're going to speak about that, there was plenty of time. Maybe I have to leave a few minutes early because I have to get somewhere before they finish. In any case, but I don't think we'll have time anyway to go into what Nadav and Avihu died for. But in any case, they did something wrong, and because of that, a fire came out of the heavens and consumed them. Didn't burn their bodies, only burnt their souls, and they died. And it really marred the simcha of the day. However, the Medrash says like this, that simcha never lasted for anybody in this world. People have happy occasions, and there's always a monkey wrench that mars the occasion. It kemat never fails. As a rabbi, and as a personal, having a lot of simchas in my life, there was always was something. I remember that after four girls born to us in Cleveland, when we lived in Cleveland, we moved to Miami, and my wife gave birth to twin boys. So you can imagine, even though looking back on it, the bigger simcha was having those four girls first. So I don't know if my wife could. After that, we had six more boys, and then another girl, and I don't think my wife could have survived without those four daughters helping her. So looking back, those four daughters were really a bracha in the beginning. In any case. But you can imagine, twin boys, tremendous simcha. And we had a twin bris. And one of my balabatim, who happened to be a doctor, came to me and he said, please, do not hire a photographer for the bris. Those days they had film. Remember what that was. Right? So... because I am an amateur and almost professional photographer, and I want the covet of doing your bris gratis. It's not my profession, right? And he said, "What's I want to be the photographer. So please do not hire a photographer." And then not everybody walked around with their own little camera or whatever. It was needed a photographer. So I was very happy. And he was snapping pictures left and right at this bris. And then... a week went by, didn't hear from him. 2 weeks went by, In those days you had to develop the film, so I figured maybe I was taking time to develop whatever. Finally, almost 3 weeks after the bris, he comes to my office with a very, very embarrassed look on his face. And I don't remember exactly what the problem was. Either he forgot to put film in the camera, or the film was defective. There were absolutely no pictures. Zero. So I said, you know what? I'm a little bit happy about that. Because there is no simcha without some kind of monkey wrench. I can handle this. Right? I don't know what else could have been. This I can handle. So in any case, my experience has been the bigger the simcha, the more problems arise. In any case, so the Medrash says like this, simcha never waited, what's it called, for anybody in this world, and the proof is Elisheva Basaminoda, Aaron's wife, Elisheva Basaminoda, saw tremendous simcha on that day. Her husband was inducted as the first Kohen Gadol. Her sons were inducted as the first regular Kohanim. Her brother was Nachshon ben Aminadav, the prince of Shevet Yehuda, who brought the first sacrifice from the Nesiim that day. Her brother-in-law was Moshe Rabbeinu, who was running the show. She had tremendous, there was never a woman with greater nachas on one day than this woman. And that day, two of her children died. So you see that simcha doesn't last too long for anybody. That's very depressing. Now, if you think that's depressing, let me tell you what the Medrash says after that. Medrash says, when God created the world, he said, I was very happy. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asov. God was happy with his creation. And I didn't last too long being happy because Adam and Chava sinned pretty much right away. And God said, if I couldn't remain happy, nobody's going to remain happy. Now that really sounds depressing. It also sounds like spite. It doesn't sound like God. I couldn't remain happy, nobody's going to remain happy. What does that mean? This world is a world of depression and nobody can be happy in this world? It's very difficult Midrash. If I didn't have an explanation, I would never have brought this Midrash up, and I beg you, do not leave before I explain it so you don't go home depressed. What it means is the following, I think. This world, to understand what the purpose of this world is, it says in Pirkei Avos, this world is like a preparation room to a castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room in order that you can go into the castle. That means if you analyze the comparison, there is no other purpose for this world except to prepare for the world to come. Nothing. That doesn't mean you sit in a corner and say Tehillim all day and prepare for the world to come. It means that the reason God created this world was to give us the opportunity to earn, or even more specifically, create our world to come. What was the purpose of creation? What we can understand, God's mind, why did he create this world? So the rabbis tell us that God, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive the ultimate good, which is a relationship with him. That's what we call the world to come. Tzadikim yoshvim va'atroseim b'rosheihem v'nehenem iziv ha'shchina. Tzadikim sit and bask in the pleasure of God's presence. An eternal relationship with God. That is the purpose of creation. So God could have created our souls, showered himself on them eternally, and that would have been it. Why do you have to put our souls into this world in a body, and then we go back to the next world? What was the purpose? So the rabbis say that God knew that if he just showered that goodness on it, it wouldn't be the total good, because it wouldn't be totally appreciated. Because what a person does not earn, or even more we'll see, what a person does not create is not appreciated as much as what you earn, and even more what you create. I think I once gave you an example. Somebody gave you one of these very plush reclining chairs and you sat in it, you'd appreciate it. But if nobody gave it to you and you had to go to work and earn the money to buy it, you'd appreciate even more. And if you planted the trees and made the chair from scratch, you'd appreciate even more. So in order for the world to come to be the ultimate good, it has to be something not only that we earn, but that we create. How do we do that? God took our souls and put them in this temporary world, into this physical world temporarily, and he said, you create the relationship with me instead of me creating with you. And God knows how long people need in this world, some people longer, some people less time, right, to be able to do that. This world is only a means to reach an end. It's not an end in itself. And person can earn and create that eternity every second, no matter what he's doing. Eating, drinking, conducting one's married life, social life, one's economic life. You can do things in a way that are godly, and then your neshama becomes more like God. Or you can do them in a way that's less godly. How do you know what's godly and what's not godly? That's why I have a Torah. The Torah gives us examples of what's a godly way of functioning and what's a not godly way. And you can then apply that to every aspect of life. And in 1 second, a person can create eternity. And everybody has their place in this world and their difficulties and challenges and the time that God allotted for them to be in this world. But the main thing is not what they accomplish here. The main thing is what they create for eternity. And that eternity can be created in 1 second. And it can be created in 120 years. So, and every person has their set of challenges in this world to remain dynamic and to create that eternity. That is why the Rav Amram put the neshama into this world. So there's no other purpose. God could have bypassed this world completely and just put our souls into the world to come and showered his goodness on it. But since he wanted us to earn and create that relationship, he put our souls in this world. So there's no other purpose to this world. And that's not exclusive. That's all inclusive. Everything in the world, animal, vegetable, mineral, everything, was created to enable man to earn his share in the world to come. Some things by using them, some things by not using them, some things by being inspired by them. And somehow, every single thing in this world can be used as a means to create eternity. And it can be done again in 1 second. And that is the purpose of this world. And that is the analogy to a preparation room for the castle. You don't build a preparation room for any other purpose than to prepare to go in the castle. You don't equip it with anything else except what you need to get into the castle. And you don't use it for anything else except to get into the castle. It's not made for any other purpose. It's not equipped for any other purpose. And it's not used for any other purpose. That's what this world is. Totally for the sake of the world to come. And therefore, every second here is precious. And the more a person can create, and more doesn't only mean more time in quantity, but quality also. Quality time. And therefore, to give another analogy, which I think I've mentioned here at some point, but I'm going to mention it again. When I was about 8 years old, the supermarket in my neighborhood in Miami had a contest. And the first prize was 15 minutes in the supermarket to take off the shelves for free whatever you could get. A woman won this contest, and they invited the whole neighborhood to come and watch her claim the prize. So I went with my brothers, Aleihem HaShalom, to watch this. It was interesting, 8 years old. It probably would interest me now, too, in any case. But it was interesting then, for sure. We went to watch this. I remember the woman was showing off the special sneakers, right, sports shoes that she bought so she could run fast through the aisles. She had two carts, one on each arm, so she wouldn't run out of space to put things in. And this is before GPSs. She had a map of the supermarket attached to her head with this thing around and something sticking out with a map and an X on all the aisles that had the most expensive items. So she knew where to go to first. And they told her, lady, we're going to say, ready, get set, go, and blow a whistle. At that point, start grabbing what you can. In 15 minutes, we're going to blow another whistle. Whatever you grab before the second whistle is yours. Whatever you grab after that whistle blows is ours. I remember they blew the whistle, and this woman started running like a meshuggah. Right? Within 5 minutes, she was sweating and breathing heavily. Imagine if somebody would have gone to her and said, "Lady, you look really tired and out of breath. Here's a chair. Have a seat. Sit down for a few minutes. Take a rest." Right? And she'd say, "Are you out of your mind? I have 15 minutes to grab what I can. In 15 minutes, when you hear that whistle, bring me 3 chairs. I'll sit here for the rest of the week. But right now is not the time to rest. Now's the time to grab." That is exactly what this world is. The Gemara says, grab what you can. It's not a place to take it easy. It's not a place to feel fulfilled. It's a place to be dynamic, because every second is precious, and every second you can create eternity. And therefore, when a person feels fulfilled, that's what it means. Simcha did not when a person feels that they've made it, there's no reason anymore for them to live. They've reached their plateau, and because of that, they want to take it easy. The Rabbanu Shalom throws a monkey wrench and says, "No, you haven't reached the plateau. There's reason to feel dynamic. There's more to accomplish. You're not perfect. It's an imperfect world, and it's supposed to be an imperfect world in order that people should feel they have to perfect themselves, that they have to go on. They have to, again, you can react to difficult situations in a very negative way, or you can react to them in a positive way and use them in a positive way. And the purpose of it is to shake you up, to agitate you, right? That's agitation. In the washing machine, that propeller in the middle is called an agitator. Haven't seen the insides of a washing machine in a long time, even though Rosh Chodesh I put the clothes in and turn on the machine for my wife, but I really haven't looked to see what it looks like. Maybe they changed washing machines. But it used to be there was a propeller in the middle that went around. That was called the agitator. It kept the clothes moving, because if they stopped moving, they wouldn't get clean. Something always has to keep people moving in this world. And sometimes they're little glitches, and sometimes they're very seriously things, like Elisheva Bas Aminodav, having two of her sons die on this day of the peak of her simcha. But the Rabbanu Shalom knew that she'd use it properly, and that she would be able to remain dynamic and move on instead of feeling fulfilled. And that's what the Medrash says. That God said, when I created the world, I could have remained happy. I could have created perfect people who never sin, who are programmed like robots, and I would have remained happy. Everybody would have been very, very nice world. But that wasn't the purpose of the world. The purpose of the world is not to create a perfect world. If I wanted a perfect world, I would have created the world to come only. I wanted this world to be imperfect, so people would feel that they have to perfect themselves. And therefore, if I didn't remain happy, because that wasn't the purpose, then nobody's going to remain happy. Not in spite, because that's not the purpose of this world. The purpose of this world is for people to feel unfulfilled, imperfect, and to constantly work towards more perfection, towards fulfilling themselves, because that's what you're here for. And taking it easy and feeling that I've reached it, I have nothing more to do, right, is counterproductive. That's what I think those medrashim mean. Another side medrash with this sin of the Nadav and Avihu, the fact that they died, the Gemara lists 10 or 11, maybe more, sins that they committed. All different opinions, what they did. Why the Gemara has to find sins, what they did, when the Torah says what they did, they brought a foreign fire, not for now. There's time at the end, which I doubt we'll maybe speak about that. If not, we'll find some other opportunity. But in any case, one of the sins was, or let me give you one of the sins was they didn't ask advice or permission from Moshe Rabbeinu to do what they did. What they did was okay. There's a mitzvah. But they should have asked permission from Moshe. And they didn't ask him permission, they didn't ask his advice. Another sin was they didn't ask their father, Aaron. They didn't consult him. That was also a sin. And then the Medrash says the following. They didn't consult each other. They didn't ask advice from each other. Now on the surface, that seems absurd, because both of them independently came to the conclusion to do what they did, to bring this strange fire. So what would have helped had they consulted each other? Both of them independently decided to do it. So what would have helped if they asked each other? They would say, had the same idea, great idea. What? How could it be that if they consulted each other, that would have helped? The answer, I think, is very simple. Chazal say, the purpose of advice is not necessarily to get information. That's one purpose. But it says that a person should ask advice even from somebody of a lesser stature. God, when he created the world, asked advice from the angels. Now, the distance between God and the angels is infinite. There's nobody greater than somebody else, than God is greater than the angels. If God could ask advice from the angels, he did it to teach us no one is too great to ask advice even from somebody smaller than them. On the surface, that doesn't make sense. If I'm an expert in car engines, okay, with the cars that I have, you have to be an expert in car engines. My mother-in-law, Aleha Shalom, I don't think knew where the motor was in the car, right? So if I hear a noise in the engine and she's passing by and I said, Ma, what do you think the problem is? First of all, it's very condescending. She think I'm making fun of her. If you don't know what it is, how in the world am I going to know? You have more information than I do about these things. So why is there an idea of asking advice from somebody who knows less than you? The answer is that the main purpose of advice is not information. The main purpose of advice in this world is usually by issues of life that a person doesn't know what he should choose. He has different options, right, in a certain issue that's facing him. He doesn't know which is the right one to choose. Now, usually in that kind of situation, there's a right and a wrong, or a better and a worse, but that's not always what you're going to choose, because there's another factor. What do you want to be right or good or the better thing? Let's say a person has to make a decision where to move. He has two neighborhoods. He has to move somewhere. He has this neighborhood and that neighborhood, and each one has pros and cons. Now, it could be, ideally, for this person, it's better for him to move to neighborhood A because the schooling there is better and the environment is better or whatever. On the other hand, the house in place B is a lot nicer. And deep down, he would really like to make the choice of living in that nice house, even though the neighborhood's not so great, the schooling's not so great, or whatever. People are very subjective and biased by what they want. And they see what they want to see, not necessarily what is objectively proper. And therefore, a person, if he's on his own, is going to weigh the pros and the cons of both of these options, and he's going to think that he came to a really good decision. But what's going to happen? He's going to see all the positive things of the option that he wants and all the negative things of the option he doesn't want, and therefore he's going to say, well, I weighed out the pros and the cons and this one went out. But it's not really what's happening. What's happening is his desires blind his eyes from seeing what the real circumstances are, and he's picking what he wants to do, not necessarily what's right. Therefore, it's important to ask advice from someone who is objective, who is not biased. He couldn't care less if you live here, you live there. Right? See, one second, there's a condition to that. And therefore, he can give you an objective view of what your issue is, instead of the subjective view that you'll see. In other words, he'll be able to delineate to you the real pros and cons of both sides. Now you can make the decision. But now it's been pointed out to you, don't see things the way you want to see them. See them as they really are. So the person can give advice by being objective. But there's a condition to that. The condition is the following. If somebody comes to you and says, I have this dilemma. I don't know where to move. Should I move to this neighborhood or this neighborhood? Now, if I say, well, what would I do if I had that dilemma? Then I am unfit to give you advice. because what I would do depends on my subjectivity. I'm already thinking how I would want, what I would want. So I'm exchanging your subjectivity for mine. You know what I really have to do? I have to say, if I was you, not if I had this issue, but if I was you, but you without your subjectivity, what would I do? I can't look at it what I would do, because I'm different than you. I have other things, and I also have what I want. But if I put myself in your shoes, with your circumstances, and say, under your circumstances, what would I do if I was you? Not if I was me who had this issue, but if I could put myself in your shoes, then I can be you without your subjectivity, without your bias, then I can give you advice. If I can't do that, then I'm not fit to give advice. So I have to be able to put myself in your place, not put you in my place. Therefore, if Nadav had come to Avihu, and this is so true, we can see it on ourselves. If Nadav had come to Avihu, who already made the decision to bring this strange fire, and he said, I have this great idea about bringing this strange fire, what do you think? And Avihu, being a great person, would have said, now if I was Nadav, how would I look at this? He'd right away see it's not the thing to do. When he's thinking about himself, his vision is distorted because of what he wanted to do. But when he projects himself into Avihu's shoes, he already can see things unbiased. Many times we do things and we have a million different excuses why it's okay what we did. But if somebody else does the same exact thing, we already pounce on them and see that it's 100% wrong what they did. And even though we did the same exact thing, but when we look at ourselves, we see it in a different light than we look at the exact same thing as somebody else does. And sometimes, I think the Baal Shem Tov says, sometimes a person commits a sin and he doesn't see that he sinned because he thinks he's okay. He has a million different justifications for what he did, sees it in a totally different perspective than it really is. Sometimes the Rabbanu Shlom then brings another person to do the same sin in front of that person, and then the person judges that person, and he's basically judging himself, because that's you. That's exactly what happened with David HaMelech. David HaMelech took Bathsheba, right? And the Navi came and gave him a whole story about this guy who had only one little sheep, and the rich man took his little sheep, right? And David HaMelech said, that guy is liable to a death penalty. And Nosson Navi said, that's you. It's exactly what you did. Except when you did it for yourself, you had 15 million justifications. When you see it by somebody else, put into very simple terms, you see it differently. So if Nadav would have asked Avihu, Avihu would have said, if I was Nadav, what would I do? He would see right away it's wrong. And the opposite also. So it would have helped for each of them to consult the other, even though independently they decided to do what they did. But had they been able to put themselves in the other one's position, it would have been a different story. Okay. Let's go to something more... simple. We know that a regular Kohen, what's it called, is allowed to become defiled to a relative that dies, but not the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol can't become defiled even to his father, his mother, or any one of the seven relatives. But a regular Kohen can, with certain stipulations. However, in this week's Sedra, the brothers of Nadav and Avihu, Nadav and Avihu were Kohanim, who had two brothers that died. And they were not allowed to mourn them, and they weren't allowed to go and take them out of, they had to send the Levium to get them out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, pull their bodies out. Why not? Brothers are allowed to defile themselves for a brother. Right? Aaron was a Kohen Gadol, so he couldn't. But why couldn't the brothers go? So they say that which a Kohen, a regular Kohen, can defile himself to relatives is only when he is already inducted as a Kohen and he's functioning as a Kohen. But the day that a Kohen becomes inducted, and every Kohen, the first day he brings a special sacrifice, and that's what they did that day, the first day that he becomes a Kohen, he becomes just like a Kohen Gadol. and his status is one that is similar to the high priest. Why? Because we explained in the past, I think, the beginning of something, the firsts are very, very special. Okay? All firsts we dedicate to God. Firstborn humans, firstborn animals, first of the crop, the first of the dough, the first shearing of the wool, right? All of the firsts are dedicated to God. Now, I am a firstborn. I have no problem believing that the first is always the best. So that's why you give the first to God. But I assume many of you are not firstborn, and you won't agree with me. And maybe in your case it's true. First isn't necessarily the best. In my case it was, but in any case, but it necessarily doesn't have to be. Okay. So why does God want the first? Why doesn't he take the best? You know, bring me a few samples, first, second, third, and bring me the best. Why the first? So explained in the past, the first sets the foundation and the root for everything that comes after it. And when you build a building, you can use second-rate cement in the first, second, and third floor, but you can't use it in the foundation. Because if there's a crack in the foundation, even a hairline crack, it endangers the entire building. And that same crack on the third floor, it makes no difference. If there's a small blemish in the root of a plant, it's going to come out 1,000 times in the tree. If there's a genetic, right, one chromosome that's missing, or then it could wreak havoc on that person. But that same deficiency in any other cell of the body after a person's already a person doesn't make any difference. So the root and the foundation have to be as perfect as possible. And therefore the day that the Kohen becomes a Kohen, is inducted as a Kohen, that's the first day. That's his root and foundation has to be as perfect as possible. Then he has to act as if he's the high priest. After that, can go down a level. But the first, the beginning, that's why Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, is very special. And people are extra careful on Rosh Hashanah and Aseret Yemei Teshuvah more than the rest of the year, because you're setting the foundation and the root for the rest of the year. So that is another idea. Now, another thing. The end of the Sedra, it speaks about a mikveh and a mayim. It's a good idea to know how a mikveh works. Okay, the Torah here in this parasha speaks about the concept of a mikveh. A mikveh has two conditions to be a mikveh. There's many other smaller conditions. The major conditions are a mikveh has to be in the ground. It can't be a vessel. You can't make a bathtub into a mikveh. Okay, it has to be something that is either dug into the ground, or there's another way of making a mikveh. You take a utensil, like you have a bathtub, and you have a big hole in the middle of the bathtub, so there's no way that it can hold water. And then you cement it to the ground, that it only became that it can hold water when it's connected to the ground. That's considered already not a vessel, but the ground. But if it could hold water before that, right, and then you connected it to the ground, it's still considered a vessel. So a mikveh has to be something connected to the ground that could not hold water until it was connected to the ground, or dug into the ground. That's one condition. Second condition, it has to have water in it that was never drawn water. Never water in a vessel. So rainwater. Go directly into the mikveh and fill it up. It was never drawn, never in a vessel. That water is kosher to be mikveh water. Okay. Third condition is that there can't be anything that that is susceptible to spiritual defilement, to tumah, that holds the water in. And therefore, if you have a mikveh, so you have to have a drain to get the water out so you can clean it. So in modern day mikvos, they don't have a drain, because there's another problem with that, and that is the water in the mikveh has to be stationary. It can't be moving. So it can't be any leaks in the mikveh. Therefore, the walls of the mikveh are usually put with waterproof coating. And if there is a drain, there is a cork made of material that can't become tameh. Either piece of wood, piece of rubber, but it can't be metal or something like that that could be susceptible to tumah. And it has to be watertight, that no water escapes when that plug is in. Because if there's water escaping, the mikveh is not kosher. A mikveh means, the word mikveh means that it is contained water. It is, that's the word, that's what the word mikveh means. It's not moving water. And you need a certain amount of water, 40 saw. 40 saw is approximately, what they have now is almost 1 million gallons of water that goes into there, but it doesn't have to be that much. It's I don't remember now exactly how much it is, but it's a certain amount. And therefore, what normally should be a mikveh is you have a big, what's it called, excavation in the ground, which you waterproof, okay, make sure that the water doesn't seep out. And today, how they get the water out when they want to clean the mikveh is with a pump. They siphon the water out. They don't have a drain because there's always a danger that it could leak. So you have a waterproof inside. The water remains contained. There's the right amount of water. There's nothing that is holding the water in, or that the water comes through vessels or anything that's susceptible to tumah. And that's a mikveh. There's only one problem. How in the world do you clean that mikveh? You fill it once, people start using it, and it gets dirty. Or it sits for a while, and it gets putrid. So how do you clean the water? You can't wait for it to rain again to fill up the mikveh. So how do they constantly clean the mikveh and fill it up? So there's two halachas of how a mikveh can be made, or three. I'll tell you three possibilities. The most common is what's done in most mikvahs, is called a bor hashaka or a bor zriya, which means the following. If you have a container of what's it called in the ground of mikveh water, okay, and again, if the mikveh has to be the dimensions of an amma by an amma by 3 ammas, 3 cubic ammas. An amma is the biggest 2 feet, okay, which is about 2/3 of a meter. So it's 2 by 2 by 3. Okay, that's 12 cubic feet. Not a big area, but it's the area that a person can, an average person can bend over and put his whole body into the water in that at one time. That's the shiur. So you have a what's it called, a container of water in the ground. Okay, water contained in the ground of that amount. If you put a hole in the wall of that container and you make that, the hole has to be a certain size, and you put that wall, the other side of the wall, you put a larger area which you fill up with tap water, drawn water, and you open the hole and the waters touch, they kiss the waters, then the water in the main area becomes mikveh water, even though it's drawn water.
Does that apply to a mikveh kelim?
Kelim too. Mikveh kelim has to be kosher, just the same thing as a woman goes in, or a man who's tamei in the time of the Torah, or whatever, time of the Beis HaMikdash, or whatever. So basically, but a mikveh kelim, a kelim mikveh is easier, because you don't have to clean it that often. But because the kelim don't usually complain that they're going into a dirty mikveh, but the women who go into the mikveh usually do complain if it's not clean. So it has to be cleaned constantly. The sometimes in a kelim mikveh, to keep it clean from algae and things like that, they put fish in it. You ever saw, they have sometimes goldfish in a kelim mikveh. That would not be great if a mikveh that women go into, right? They would not like to share the mikveh with fish, right? Some husbands would like to their women wives to share the mikveh with piranha fish, but in any case, that would not be very appetizing. So in any case, the that's one possibility. So you have, that's what they do. They have fill up with the rain in a bore, right? Small, what's it called, minimal size for a mikveh, which is almost impossible for anybody really to get into, and they make a hole in that wall and fill the other side with water, and when the waters in the rainwater reservoir touch the waters that were filled into the Beis HaTvila, the place where you actually immerse, they become, the place where you immerse becomes mikveh water. That's one way. There's a second way. That's called Zriya. You fill a bore with 40 saw of water, of rainwater, and then you pour water into it, and it overflows into an immersion place. The water that goes in is considered like it's being planted in the kosher water, and it becomes kosher water. And not a good example. Ever play tag? So if you're, what's it called, touching somebody who's touching the base, so you become also free. So if the water touches the kosher water, it becomes kosher water. And it remains like that, according to most opinions, even if the hole is closed up. Once it touched, once. The minig is to make sure that that hole is always open when somebody is immersing, because it may only remain mikveh water when the two are touching. If it stops touching, then it reverts back to being the old drawn water. There's some other halachas also of how the water has to get into the original mikveh. It can't come through anything that could receive tumah, nothing metal or whatever, and it also usually is put onto ground that could absorb that water for at least 3 tvachim, which is about 9 inches, before it goes into the reservoir, because that takes away the problem of to a certain degree of drawn water. So they don't pour the water directly into that bore. They pour it in on the ground, and then it goes over like cement or whatever, which theoretically, if left there long enough, would be absorbed into the cement, and then it goes into the mikveh. But that's a mikveh. So the mikveh, most mikvos here in Eretz Yisrael have 2 boros, and in all the world. They have, it's filled up by taking the tap water and putting it into the first reservoir, and then it overflows into the place where you immerse. And just to be extra careful, they have another reservoir on the side of the mikveh of rainwater that every time you immerse, you open that hole and the two waters touch, and it becomes rain, like rainwater, mikveh water. That's a mikveh. And again, if the mikveh is leaking, it's a very big problem. It's not kosher. There's another kind of place that you can become tahor in, is a mayan. A mayan is a spring, a natural spring. That doesn't have to be 40 saw, according to many opinions. For a keli, for sure. A keli mikveh, that's a mikveh, has to have the same amount of water as a human being goes in, even if you're just tobling a thimble. But a mayan, for kelim, is good even if it's not 40 saw, according to many opinions. And a mayan is good if it's moving. It's only good if it's moving, because that's a spring. Spring water moves. Spring water can be a natural river that's not mainly rainwater, but that comes from the underground springs. Some rivers are rainwater, they're not kosher, because they're moving. And some rivers are spring water, and they are kosher. The ocean is kosher to be a mikveh, even though the waves move. That's what's it called. The ocean has a special halacha. But a river could be kosher, could be not kosher. It depends what its source is. If its source is rainwater mostly, it's not kosher if it's moving. And if its source is underground springs, then it is kosher even if it's moving, and specifically if it's moving.
Let the water
into a what?
If you let the water into the bigger surface, then you have to just shut it off again.
Right.
Because it'll empty all out.
Right. Well, yeah. The what happens is that you don't want there to be an interchange between the water too much. You want the original rainwater to remain. So that's why there's a cork that when they're not immersing, that cork is in there to keep the water separate. But that's very important. That's one of the jobs of the mikveh lady. she makes sure she takes that cork out before somebody immerses. So while they're immersing, the waters are connected. The water in the reservoir with the rainwater is connected to the immersion place, which is constantly cleaned and refilled, and you don't have to wait for it to rain every time. And usually they don't change those boros for maybe a year or two, until there's a good rain, and then you have to dry it out. It's a long process how to change that water. So it's not done more than once a year, the most, maybe once every 2 or 3 years. And that's why in those boros, they usually put chlorine or whatever to make sure it's stagnant water that doesn't become contaminated. Okay, but that's what a mikveh is. Okay, one more thing. Torah says that fish do not need to be shechted. Theoretically, you could do like they used to do in the colleges in America in the 60s and swallow live goldfish, and there's nothing wrong with that halachically, except the fact that it is considered disgusting and you're not allowed to do disgusting things. So you really have to kill a fish before you eat it, but not mandatory. And there's no shechita, you don't shech the fish. Let the fish die, knock it over the head, take it out of the water for a while. That's how fish usually are killed. There's no shechita. A bird, okay, has to have shechita. What's shechita by an animal? What's of the animal? How do you shecht an animal? So there are two pipes that go down the neck. One is called the trachea, or the windpipe, that connects to the lungs, and the other one is called the esophagus, and that eventually connects into the stomach. That's the food pipe. Those two pipes have to be cut most of the way by an animal, by a cow, by a lamb, or whatever. And there are other halachas of shechita too, right? What's it called? It has to be a knife that has no nicks in it, perfectly sharp, no nicks. You can't shech by putting pressure on the animal, but it has to be with a swift cut. You can't hide the knife under the skin or under the hair. It has to be, exposed the whole time. Those are some of, and it has to be done in the proper place, not too high, not too low. Those are the laws of shechita by an animal. And you have to cut most of the esophagus and most of the windpipe. In a bird, in a chicken, there you only have to cut most of one of them, either the esophagus or the windpipe. Most of the time they shut both of them anyway. But halachically, only one has to be cut most of the way by a bird. By a fish, there's no halach of shechita altogether. You can eat a fish to die by itself or whatever. One of the reasons being, the idea of shechita is that you want to take the life of that animal in the most humane way. Torah said this is the most humane way to do it. An animal has the most life force, more than a bird. Animals were created from the earth. The earth is more substantive. So the life force of an animal is stronger than the life force of a bird. Birds were created from mud, from water and earth together. And the water has less of a substance to it. And therefore, what's it called? The life force of the bird is less than the life force of an animal. And therefore, you only have to take it away in a lesser way. Only one of those, esophagus or the trachea. And a fish is in water completely. So it has even less of a life force, and therefore you don't have to have any special way of killing it. And everything about the fish is kosher. The blood of an animal, right, is not kosher. Blood of a bird is not kosher, right, at least rabbinically or whatever, from a fish. Unless you take the blood and put it in the cup, and you can't tell the difference between that blood and animal blood, then you're not allowed to drink it. But if you keep scales in there, you could drink fish blood too, as long as it's clear that it's fish blood. There's no fats. In an animal, there's fats that are prohibited. In a bird, there are no fats that are prohibited. But in an animal, yes. And by a fish, nothing is prohibited. There's no fat that's prohibited. There's no blood that's prohibited. You could eat basically the whole fish. And theoretically, you could even eat it alive. a bird or an animal that you cut off meat from when it's alive is a Torah prohibition to eat that. So the idea of taking the life of these animals depends on how much of a life force it has. An animal has the most life force, you need to shecht it and take away its life in a more specific way. A bird has less, a fish has even less, and therefore the fish doesn't have any special life. Should leave you not to eat till tomorrow morning.
Two weeks from time, your friend.